Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 2nd, 2012. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, a collaborative experiment on wort chilling, or not chilling. We invite you to collaborate with Andy Davison of the Australian National Homebrew Conference and Chris Colby of Brew Your Own Magazine to test the effects of different chilling methods on your beer. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook as well, facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You know how it works. Whenever you think of Amazon.com, think of us first. Go to our website and click on our associate link, the Amazon logo there. Click on that first. It'll take you to Amazon, and then invisibly and miraculously and magically, whatever you buy during that session on the web, we'll get a piece of. And we greatly appreciate your support in doing that. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. Check out our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps. And we're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on Stitcher as well. Some exciting news was released this week. Jack McAuliffe, a brewing pioneer whom you've heard on this show, is collaborating with Jim Cook of the Boston Beer Company to re-release New Albion Ale. You'll remember from our conversation with Jack that New Albion is known as the first craft brewery in the United States. Unfortunately, the brewery was only in existence from 1976 to 1982. But thanks to Jim Cook, we'll have an opportunity to taste New Albion Ale again. The beer will be previewed at a special tasting at the Great American Beer Festival, and it'll be released early next year, and I believe it's going to be a limited run. So when you see it, get it. Very exciting news for Jack. By the way, Jack told me about this in May and asked me not to say anything. So there you go. I can keep a secret. For more information, check out the blog of Jack's daughter, Renee DeLuca, at brewersdaughter.com. You can follow her on Twitter at brewersdaughter. All one word. Speaking of GABF, at the time of this recording, the AHA member presale is going on now, and the public ticket sale begins August 2nd. This thing sells out quickly. It happens in Denver, October 11th through 13th, and Andy and I are planning to be there. We tend to go every other year or so. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Dave from St. Louis writes, "Just listened to the Sour Mash Berliner Weiss episode. Instead of tossing spent grains into my garden, could I use them to make a sour beer? Would I have to add some simple sugars, or could I just rely on the yeast to eat the starches and any residual simple sugars?" That's a great question. And as luck would have it, Scott Schluter, whom you've heard on this podcast in the past, coincidentally, he posted the following on our Facebook page. Scott says, "Since we did those Party Guile sour beers mentioned during your interview on the Party Guile's Gone Wild podcast, I've used the sour mash method to squeeze out what I call a bonus beer many times with mostly good luck. What I do is at the end of a brew day of a moderate to strong beer, I don't throw out the grains. I do brew in a bag. So I pitch the whole bag into a round cooler. I stir in a couple pounds of crushed two-row and a couple ounces of torrefied wheat. Scott says, I find the first mash strips out head retention proteins. At least that's what I guess it does, he says. He takes a temperature reading after that. He says, I then prepare a couple of gallons of strike water to reach around 120 degrees Fahrenheit and stir it in. I press plastic wrap onto the top of the mash and screw the top on. I take my brew-in-a-bag insulating comforter and wrap the cooler. I let that sit undisturbed for 24 to 48 hours. Then the brew day is on. I heat a couple of gallons of water to 170 degrees Fahrenheit and dunk spards the grains in it and wring the snot out of it," Scott says. And he says in all caps, "Don't fear the funk." It usually smells horrible. I pour the wort from the cooler in, top up to 5 gallons, plus my boil-off, and take a gravity reading. I calculate the probable original gravity and do a 60-minute hop addition to reach around 12 IBUs. Scott says, sometimes I do coriander and or grains of paradise. I do a 60-minute boil, cool, ferment with a clean yeast, and bottle as normal without worry of contamination of my equipment on future non-sour beers. What I get is a very light, 2 to 4% ABV lemony pucker beer, all for a couple bucks in grains, hops, and yeast. I often just let the blow off from the first beer dump into the sour beer to ferment for even more frugality. There you go. Awesome post. And all that was done in just a comment under the description of last week's show. So if it can be done, a homebrewer has done it. Thanks to Scott for posting that on our Facebook page. Very interesting. And then there's this bit of fun from Steven in Las Vegas. Steven says, just wanted to say happy 7th anniversary. Well, thanks. I forgot to mention it. It was just went right on by. We're in our 8th year here at Basic Brewing Radio. Steven says, I've been listening since the 2nd episode. Holy smokes. So I've been along for all the fun and great info. Man, you'd need some kind of a medal for all that. Steven says, I've even learned a few things along the way. Well, I've learned a lot. I wanted to share my 10 tips for spotting a craft beer / homebrew drinker. Okay, here we go. If I had a drum roll, I would use it. Number 10 is the only person drinking beer out of a pint glass at a party. Number 9 is constantly explaining the difference between an ale and a lager to people that don't care. Can usually be found sipping something the color of motor oil out of a goblet very slowly. Laughs when a beer commercial claims its beer is triple hopped. Will take 10 minutes to explain to a bartender how to pour a beer. Often sniffing the contents of their glass with a satisfying, ah. Approves of born-on dates, but only on a barley wine or a mead. At least half of their t-shirts have beer logos on them. Is always trying to explain why their homebrew tastes bitter to their plain beer friends. And number one, the number one tip on how you can spot a craft beer / homebrew drinker, has a beer bottle opener on their keychain. That's the sound of my beer bottle opener on my keychain. Guilty as charged in all 10. I would add that I also look on for born-on dates with the hoppy beers as well. So I've posted Steven's list on our Facebook.com/basicbrewing page so that you can add your tip for spotting a lover of good beer. And you need those because that's who you need to gravitate towards when you go to a party. Okay, let's move on to our intercontinental interview. Andy Davison approached me with the idea of doing a collaborative experiment comparing different chilling methods. Now, the plan is to share the results of the experiment at the Australian National Homebrew Conference in October. I think it's a great idea, and especially with all the talking that we've done about no-chill brewing in particular, I think we should take a closer look at how we chill our wort. Well, Andy Davison, good morning, and welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing well. And Chris Colby, good evening, and welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Good evening, James. Thanks for having me on your show.
We're doing the time warp here. And I know it's cliche to talk about the time difference, but I still am amazed that we can pull this off. We're going to talk about two things combined. First is an exciting event coming up down there in Melbourne. Is the Australian National Homebrew Conference. And Andy, you're the conference chair, right?
I am indeed. So we're down back in Melbourne coming up in October on the 25th to 27th. So trying to pull as many homebrewers together as we can from around the country to share the information, get together, share each other's beers, and just have a fantastic time.
And this is an every other year event for you guys.
It is. This is number 3 for us. And, you know, we've tried to stitch together a program and a set of events that are bigger than we've had before. So.
And how many people attend?
Well, the last couple of months we've had around about 220, and that's our capacity. This year we've got a little bit more room, and we're running, as well as the sort of advanced sessions that we normally run, we're running a beginner's program as well. So we're trying to share the information not just amongst the people that are really enthusiastic already about homebrewing, but get those folks that are just starting out their homebrew journey and give them some information to help them lift up the quality of those beers.
And you've got some special guests coming from both your country and ours as well.
Wow, do we ever. From your side of the pond, we've got Matt Brindleson coming over from Firestone Walker. We've got John Palmer's coming out again. Of course, How to Brew legend. Kai Troister's coming out for us, one of the Basic Brewing Radio family. So we're really looking forward to talking to Kai. We've got Christian Scoville Anderson from Beer Here in Denmark. So that's going to be fantastic, sort of getting someone from the other direction of the globe. And then a whole lot of local presenters as well from a variety of places. So we've got Tina's coming out to talk about or do a sensory perception session for us. We've got Dan Dayton, who's one of the brewers out at James Squire Brewery. He's coming to talk to us about his journey from home brewer to professional brewer. And, a whole lot more. So it's going to be a great conference.
Now, at the American Homebrew Conference up here, we have Club Night and we have Pro Night. Do you guys have anything similar to that?
Yeah, we do. We're running on the Pro Night side. We've got an industry day that we're running just before the conference. So a whole lot of people will be getting together from microbreweries around the country to talk to some of the guests that we've got coming from overseas, as well as some of the industry experts down here. And then we've got Club Night, of course, which is huge, just as is over there. And we're looking to make that one longer and bigger this year. So hopefully all the homebrew clubs are getting their stuff together. I know that my homebrew club's got some big plans this year, so it's going to be good fun.
Well, you've approached Chris and me because you've invited us to appear electronically down there. Now, what's your idea?
Yeah, so you guys have been running the collaborative experiments for a couple of years now, and one of the things that we had in the last conference was a System Wars, which was a bit of an experiment to see whose style of brewing system was going to be produce the better beer. So we're going down that road again to sort of settle the age old discussion of can a no chilled beer be hoppy, and do you get DMS if you don't run if you don't chill your beer fast enough? So we're running with three different chilling systems down here on the 22nd of September at Grain and Grape, which is a Saturday morning. And we're basically going to take a single batch of wort. We'll separate that, give it to three separate brewers to chill using their techniques. That'll come together again. Well, we won't bring them together, but we'll hop them all the same. We'll dose them with yeast all the same, and then we'll ferment them in the same environment. So we're looking to have a controlled experiment that really just looks at, does the chilling technique have any impact on the hoppiness of the beer? And then, of course, also, while we're at it, we might as well measure some things that talk about the actual mechanism itself. And, how green is your chilling technique? So how do you use the water after you finish? How much water do you use? How fast do you chill? All those sorts of things.
Interesting. So you guys are the fathers of no-chill brewing down there, as well as brew in a bag. Are there no-chill skeptics down there as well?
Absolutely. We've got skeptics for everything down here, you name it. And that's just one of them. So a lot of people down here are super advocates for brewing. And as you pointed out, we sort of seem to have come up with the technique down here in an environment that's pretty hostile for not chilling. So
yeah, that's a good point. I mean, water is a precious commodity down there, as it's becoming around here in our neck of the woods as well, with the hot summer and the drought that we've got going on here. So there are practical and environmental considerations to think about with your chilling technique.
Absolutely. We've got a lot of people that spend a lot of time and effort on things like pulling their chill water out of rainwater tanks and then recycling it back into the tank or back into the garden or whatever it might be. So, you know, part of the question is, okay, if you're going to no chill, then you've got another thing that you've got to clean and sanitize. And, you know, what does that do with respect to water? So if you're going to count the amount of water you use, it can't just be, okay, well, we're no chill, so we don't use water.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be, all right, well, we no chill, and therefore we do use a bit of water in the cleaning process. So what does that add up to compared to what we use in an immersion chiller, in a counterflow chiller, in a plate chiller?
That's a good point. So, Chris, you are sort of a no-chill skeptic, aren't you?
Sure.
We are casting you.
I'll play one on Skype if not.
we're casting you as the bad cop in this episode. So as the no-chill skeptic, what things are you looking at with a skeptical eye as far as not chilling your work quickly?
Well, there's a couple reasons. The standard reasons given for chilling your work quickly are one that in any brewery, there's going to be the potential for wort-spoiling bacteria to be there. And the faster you cool down your wort, and especially the faster you get it through the range of temperatures that's high enough that the microbes will thrive, the quicker you get it down through those temperatures, the less likely you are to, enrich any contamination that you would have in the beer.
So I'll play the good cop on the no chill, because I've gotten lots and lots of email from no chill brewers, and if I were good at it, I would affect an Australian accent, but I'm not going to do that. But Chris, I do no chill, and I put my wort in the jerry can, and I seal it up nicely, and I can wait 3 or 4 weeks before I brew. And my wort doesn't spoil. Now you go on to your next point.
Yeah, well, one thing with the no chill on that, if you were to quickly get the wort into some sealable container before it got down to a temperature where contamination could take hold, then you're it's almost like canning at that point. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although
so,
you don't.
Yeah, you would expect that if you could get the boiling wort quickly into a can, or not a can, but a container with no airspace and seal it all off, and that was sanitized previously. Yeah, that would benefit you greatly.
Although technically it's not canning. I mean, you're not reaching canning temperatures, and this is a low acid food essentially. So
yeah, so you're almost canning.
Yeah, which could almost be safe.
Yeah, right.
And I guess get around the whole airspace thing by sort of saying, all right, well, let's tip the cube upside down, and that sterilizes that part of the vessel as well. So yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that it's good to squeeze the cube or squeeze the jerry can to get as much air out as possible. So yeah. What's your next skeptical point, Chris?
The next skeptical bad cop point would be that if you brewed, or standard theory would tell you that if you brewed a beer using very, very pale color malts, like a Pilsner malt or a lot of the sort of lowly kilned United States malts, that you would get DMS formed from the slow cooling. You know, normally one of the reasons given for a quick cool is that as the wort cools, it gives off a little bit of DMS, and the slower that you chill it with having used these lightly colored malts, the more DMS you'll get.
You want to take that one, Andy?
Yeah, look, I've argued the same thing for years over here at BJCP sessions and the like, where, you know, the likelihood is if what you are doing is using a malt that has high SMM, then you should see, if you don't chill it down to below 80 quickly enough, you should see a lot of DMS produced in that period that it's sitting between 80 and 100. And I swear, I get every time someone's telling me, no, I don't get it. I brew with a Continental Pils malt and I don't get DMS. It's all good. So, I've got some theories about you know, batch sizes and things like that, where if you maybe if you've got a commercial volume and it might be the rate of transition in that period that means that you don't get DMS forming in a small batch because the small batch chills fast enough naturally. It could be any of those things, but you know, for me, the science sort of says to me, I'm expecting to see a higher DMS content in my beer.
And I've even heard people say that when you're chilling, you either don't want to have the lid on the kettle, or you don't want the condensation to drip from the lid back into the kettle because you'll get more DMS production that way. I've even heard, you know, people cautious to that extent as well.
Well, I reckon there's another experiment in this to take that and actually put it through a condenser and find out whether or not the stuff's in there. Right?
That's another experiment. So what else, Chris? I mean, what else are you concerned about with no chill or not chilling your wort quickly enough?
I think those would be the major two, aren't they?
Yeah, and I would add another one. Hop character, especially the character of hops added late in the boil. When you add hops late in the boil, you're hoping to capture or at least retain those juicy and piney and you know, kind of fragile, volatile compounds that give you really good hop flavor and aroma. And one would think that in an extended period of time, at close to boiling temperatures, that those compounds would be denatured or would be damaged and wouldn't be as hoppy, say, or in a juicy sort of way as, say, an American IPA. Do you have any responses to that, Andy? Do you hear from brewers who say they can do that?
Yeah, absolutely. But at the end of the day, late hopping doesn't count. So, you know, it's about, for us, it's about trying to ascertain what impact does it have on the hops that you're putting in to the boil, not the hops you're adding in to the fermenter. So no, the taking dry hopping out of the argument, because, of course, if you dry hop a no-chill beer, you're going to get a hoppy beer. But what are those nice round hop characters that we get out of a late flavor addition? What's happening to those in a no-chill environment? And, you know, there's a lot of argument about that in both directions down here, and I know that even doing this experiment, we're not going to quell that argument, but by crikey, we're going to have a crack at it.
Yeah, I guess it may be a difference of terms between the continents, but when I refer to late hopping, I mean late additions to the boil and not dry hopping.
No, that's just not me not being up early enough, right?
No,
you're right. I did mean the dry hopping.
Okay.
Doesn't count, yeah.
Now, Andy, you heard our experiment that we recorded with Bob Stemsky and Noam Shalev in Seattle, right?
Mm-hmm. I did indeed.
Now that to me was a fairly eye-opening experience. But it one thing that it didn't answer was that late hopping question, because I think most of Noam's hops were for bitterness, and then Bob dry hopped his beer, both halves of his experiment. So that kind of negated the effect of the hops in the boil on that one. So
yeah, that was my take as well. So it'll be interesting to see what we can do here and sort of eliminate that as a variable and see if we get the same outcome.
Now, if people don't want to buy the container to do no chill, they can still participate in the experiment, right?
Absolutely. You know, both on the hop side and on the process side. So, you know, on the hop side, we're trying to capture some information about the nature of the hop flavor that's in the beer in the end result. But then, of course, the key one that they'd be able to help out with is to collect some information about the various techniques of chilling and the mechanics of it. So how much water do you use? What do you do with the water afterwards? Are you being green about it, or are you just dumping it down the drain? Things like what are your temperature gradients? So measure your temperature when you start the chill process, measure it at the end, how long did it take. You know, if you've got an opportunity to take a couple of measurements through that chilling process in case what you're seeing is a nonlinear sort of temperature drop. Do you get a soft or a harsh bitterness? Is it a nice round hop character in the flavor? So all of those things are parameters that we're looking to capture.
And if you're doing, you could do an immersion chiller versus a plate chiller, and you'll want to measure the temperature of your tap water.
Yep.
You'll want to, like you said, measure how long it takes to get down to temperature. And I think it'd be really interesting to measure how much water we actually use. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I guess one easy way that you could do is you could hook up your chiller, turn your faucet on to the strength that you usually run during your chilling, and then see how long it takes to fill up, say, a liter or a gallon of water.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could figure out by how long you ran the chiller during the chilling process, how much water you actually used. That'd be a lot easier than, say, filling up a big bucket.
But not as much fun, right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
You could go swimming in the bucket afterwards. You never know.
Just don't go swimming quickly, because that water that comes out first is pretty hot.
Okay, a spa.
Yeah.
But, you know, and non-chill has a part to play here. You know, a lot of people are using swimming pools, so they'll you know, crank their cube shut, chuck it in the swimming pool to chill it down.
Ah.
You know, tell us if you're doing that. If it's just ambient, what's the ambient temperature? How's that ambient temperature changing in the 8 hours that your beer's coming down out of that 80 degree zone?
And I've got an infrared thermometer so that and by the way, I got my plastic container the other day, so I'm awesome. I'm all ready. but I've got the infrared thermometer, so I could take a temperature of the outside of that container to get sort of an idea of how hot the wort is and how long it actually does take to chill down to room temperature.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
What are you thinking, Chris?
Yeah, I actually got an IR thermometer recently too. Yeah. I think this will be an interesting experiment. I mean, we can do you know, if they're set up and they have the stuff to do at no chill, they can do you know, their regular version of chilling, like immersion chilling versus no chill. Or if they don't, they can do immersion chilling versus, say, a counterflow chiller or a plate chiller or some other method that they want. You know, if they some people, you know, I know, try to cool their fermentation buckets down in their bathtub, you know,
mm-hmm.
put the hot wort in there, and it's sort of a low rent way of trying to, you know, save buying an immersion chiller when you first start out. I think it should be an interesting experiment. And we've got there's several interesting questions in it. The DMS thing, are there methods that are more prone to contamination? What happens to, you know, hop character that's been added late in the boil? And that sub-question is actually also interesting when you talk about immersion chillers versus counterflow chillers. Because when you chill with an immersion chiller, all of your wort in bulk moves, you know, gets chilled at the relative same time. I mean, there's you know, different temperatures within your wort, but basically you're cooling it all down in bulk. Where in a counterflow chiller, you're running it and cooling just a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So the last little bit of wort that you run through the chiller has been sitting there for, you know, however long it takes you to drain your kettle through your counterflow chiller. So, and you know, you would expect then that maybe to be extracting a little bit more from the hops as it, you know, because it's sitting there with at a higher temperature near boiling.
That's a good point.
So yeah, I think this can be an interesting experiment. It's very, very doable. Either, you know, people could brew two separate batches and just do the exact same thing and use a different chiller. Or in some cases, you could do it as a split batch. Like if you're going to do the no chill versus some other form of chilling, you could brew, say, 10 gallons, run 5 off, you know, and use the no chill method on that, and then, you know, start your chilling with the immersion chiller or counterflow or whatever, and do a split batch in that. So there's, you know, a couple different ways the experiment can be set up too, and it'll be, and, you know, I think there's some interesting questions here and the potential to get a pretty good answer.
Yeah, we forgot about ice baths too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did a 2 gallon sour mash Belgian wit or Belgian wit. The other BW, there are 3 BW beers: Belgian wit, Berliner Weiss, and barley wine. And it was the a Berliner Weiss. There may be more, but anyway, I used an ice bath with 10 pounds of ice and some water mixed in to chill down the wort, and it worked pretty well for those 2 gallons.
That ice counts as water, right?
That's right. That's right. So I think that this experiment will give me an opportunity to resurrect my converted keg. A kettle from the basement, which I haven't used in a long time, mainly because it takes a darn long to chill down, you know, for me to chill down 10 gallons of wort with an immersion chiller. So So now what I can do is just turn on the spigot and drain half of my wort into my plastic container for the no-chill side, and then fire up the chiller and take measurements and chill down the other half. So I'm excited about that.
What kind of container did you get for the no-chill?
It's one that was recommended by Bob Stimsky.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I guess I can put a link to it in the description of this episode, although I don't want to endorse the company that necessarily that I bought it from. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. No, I'm just curious. It's like, you know, something designed for water?
It's a food grade. It's designed for food ingredients and food products, so it's got an FDA rating and it's apparently safe for the purpose. So that's one thing, is you do want to have
it doesn't melt.
Yeah, exactly. You do want to have a container that is built to withstand those temperatures. I was working at a fast food restaurant when I was in high school, and some of the teenagers that I was working with thought it would be a great idea to drain the fry grease into this plastic pickle bucket as they were filtering it. And I wasn't there, but they said the pickle bucket basically just disappeared. And you don't want that to happen at your house.
And that's really important, too, because, you know, plastics are food grade rated as food grade at different temperatures. So you need to make sure that, you know, your container is actually food grade at 100 degrees Celsius.
Right. Right. So we want to look at flavor, aroma, clarity. You know, there's been some discussion of, you know, when the cold break happens, and is it more efficient? Is the cold break more efficient if it happens more quickly, or if it happens slowly over time?
Oh, that's a good one, too. I forgot about that.
So, yeah, there's a lot to think about. Take plenty of notes, and we will we'll try to get together and pass a document back and forth and see if we can get a data form that everybody likes and that we can put on the Basic Brewing website, so that when you get your data, you can use that as a guide to fill that out. So, yeah, this is exciting. I think if we can get people not to just do hoppy pale ales, but to do different styles, maybe even a Pilsner, or something, or maybe a Belgian triple or something like that with a bunch of Pilsner malt in it, and see if we can get some differences in those DMS flavors or the hop flavor and aroma. I think that this promises to be a really interesting experiment.
Yeah, and we're going to run the experiment on the program. Well, not live from the conference, but we'll certainly have the session available, I think, the week after, you said.
Yeah, and we can run the if all the technical things work out, we can play what happened the week after.
You know, so if people want to kick along, we can give you the recipe that we'll be using down here on stage, and you can sort of compare your results with the same sort of recipe against what the guys are getting up on the stage.
Yeah, if you'll send me a PDF of that recipe, I can put it up in the description of this episode as well.
Will do.
And with the deadline, have we mentioned the deadline? October 8th is the deadline to get your data in. That should give you plenty of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you know, you might have an opportunity to do a couple of batches at that rate. So I know I'm going to try to.
Or to get your club together and, have a club brew day and get a couple of guys at the same time using different chilling techniques.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Get somebody with a big brewing system and fill it up and try several different chilling techniques all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a party.
Does indeed. Lots of beer, hopefully.
Well, what do you think? Is there anything else that we need to cover? Any tips or anything that people ought to look out for?
Don't think so. I'm just jealous that I'm the only one out of the three of us that hasn't got an infrared thermometer.
get one with a little laser pointer on it, because my dog, if you have pets, they love to play with the little lasers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. And drive the animals crazy.
Yeah.
move the dot over the room, and the cats just swarm at it.
Awesome. In fact, when I get down to the chilling phase in my brewing process, my dog hangs around me now because she knows that I've got the infrared thermometer and I'm testing the temperature in the kettle, and so Pavlov would be proud.
Many experiments in one. Gotta love that.
Keeps you and the dog entertained. Well, all right, guys. We will be corresponding via email between now and then, and we will get some info up for people to look at, and hopefully we can get a bunch of folks to participate. And we will see you virtually in Melbourne.
We're looking forward to having you guys on the big screen down in Melbourne for the conference. So. And thanks for being a part of it, guys. It's going to be great.
Awesome.
Yeah, it should be fun.
Well, thanks again to Andy and to Chris. Once again, the deadline is October 8th, and I hope to get the form up very soon for you to enter your data. I will post a link to the plastic container that Bob Stemsky recommended and that I have purchased, but I haven't used it yet, so the link is not an endorsement in any way. I'm not saying that this is what you must buy for no-chill brewing. It's just to give you an idea of what some brewers are using as their no-chill container. So just use it as a piece of information. Take a look at it. And if you can find something similar somewhere else, please do. I'm looking forward greatly to the results of this one, as usual. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and Zombie Jim, and Masterbuilt 30-inch electric smokehouse smoker. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com as well. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.